U.S. businesses thrive on Alibaba's online marketplace, where sales by American companies to Chinese consumers added $53 billion to the U.S. economy in 2022. Discover more at AlibabaPowersBusinesses.com.
From the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal, this is Potomac Watch.
President Trump brings back his televised coronavirus briefings, plus where do negotiations stand in Congress on the next coronavirus relief bill. Welcome, I'm Kyle Peterson with the Wall Street Journal, sitting in today for Paul Jugot. We are joined as usual by my colleagues Kim Strassel. Hi, Kim.
Hi, Kyle.
And Bill McGurn. Hi, Bill.
Hi, Kyle.
On Tuesday, President Trump was back at the White House lectern in the press room for a live coronavirus briefing, the first time that he's done that since April, when he discontinued those briefings after criticism. It was short, about 25 minutes of Trump mostly reading off of a script, and then he took a few questions at the end. Bill, do you think that bringing back these briefings is a good communication strategy for the president in the White House at this point?
Well, he's kind of damned if he does, damned if he doesn't. It depends what kind of briefings. It looks like from today, they've realized that what they were doing before with these confrontations with reporters and so forth, and kind of, a focus on the president didn't help him at all. In fact, hurt him. So yes, I think, look, people are looking for answers. The epidemic is still out there. People are still suffering from it, and they expect the commander in chief to have some answers for it. So I think a lot of it will depend on how he does it. That said, of course, some of the damage may have been done that he can't undo. But again, people do want to have answers, and it would be good if the White House could communicate those answers.
And the format, at least on Tuesday, was, as you say, much more subdued. I mean, Trump talked about tests and fatality rates. He encouraged wearing of face masks, said, quote, "I will use it gladly, no problem with it," where he said he'd been reluctant before to go out in a face mask. He said he was, quote, "imploring young Americans to avoid packed bars and other crowded indoor gatherings," unquote. All good advice in my view, and I guess maybe, Kim, as Bill alludes to, the question is whether he can keep up that sort of consistent messaging.
Yeah, this struck me very much as an attempt at a reset, because there are people in the White House who have pointed out correctly that this is an enormous bully pulpit and an opportunity to be in front of the nation. It just comes down to how you use that time and do you use it wisely. And one thing that unfortunately happened when President Trump decided to lay off the briefings, because it's as Bill said, it's almost damned if you do, damned if you don't. When he stopped doing it, the narrative, at least among the mainstream press, was, oh, this is a president he's past it. He doesn't care about it anymore. He just wants everything to reopen. All he cares about is the economy and reelection. And so in doing this and in doing it in a very controlled fashion, he signaled that he understands it's still very serious, that we need to continue dealing with this threat. He expressed a lot of empathy for those that have dealt with it. Again, as you said, put out a public service message about the best ways to handle it. But it all comes down, once again, as Bill said, can he keep that up? Especially, he took some questions and he tended to answer them in a more controlled fashion than he often does. But the press was in a cycle, and they love it, of goading him when he would go up there, and he would always fall for it, always take the bait. So as this goes along, if he continues to do it, can he maintain that posture? Or does, and I've also heard this in some of my reporting, does he kick this off as the first of a renewed set of briefings? And does he hand it over at that point to Mike Pence or to Deborah Birx or to Anthony Fauci to continue the public service message of it?
What do you think of that idea, Bill, of having the president do a few initial briefings and then leaving it to Pence or some of the infectious disease specialists? I mean, on the one hand, you can see how that would give some credibility, some heft to the briefings. On the other hand, part of what Trump, I think, is trying to signal here is that he's locked into this issue. He knows it's a problem, and the federal government is working on it.
Again, I think it's another damned if you do, damned if you don't situation. If Trump doesn't show up at the briefings, then everyone will be writing about how he's afraid to do it, that he knew he blew it, and so forth. The story will be Trump. If he does, people will criticize him for what he did before. I think he can do it if he does it in a limited way. One of the problems, I think, with the earlier briefings is just they went on and on and on. And I think that keeping them short and crisp and sticking to the, the message of the day, just put that out there and then leave and let people answer questions. Instead, it was way too expansive before. It seemed to never end. And I think that was part of the problem too.
As someone who has watched most or all of these briefings, I would wholeheartedly agree with that. The old ones going on for an hour and a half or something like that. Though even if the briefing itself is short and crisp, it seems like you do have the problem of Trump then going on Twitter the next night and undercutting whatever message is being put out. Another notable thing to me is that there is also some clear jockeying over blame going on here. President Trump at the briefing called it, again, as he often does, the quote China virus, blamed China for letting this loose on the world. Nancy Pelosi, in an interview on CNN, took a different tack. She said that the virus, quote, has gotten worse before it will get better because of his inaction, meaning the president's. And then she continues, and in fact, clearly it is the Trump virus, unquote. So, Kim, I mean, clearly there is some political jockeying going on here at the same time. I mean, of course, we're in the middle of a presidential election.
Just as I think it's just as important to point out what she said after those comments, which in my mind was the really more shameful part of her statement, which was she was pressed by the host. Are you suggesting that Donald Trump is responsible for the deaths of people in this? And she said, yes. And that to me, that's just outrageous. It's nakedly political. This is a global pandemic, and this virus doesn't make distinctions between Republicans and Democrats and who it infects. It's something that the whole country has needed to pull together to cope with. It's ravaged other parts of the world as well, too. And one day we will look back on this and make a better decision or learn something about the best way to have handled this. But it was unprecedented. I don't think that you can doubt that everyone was doing the best job that they could do, whether that be Democratic state governors, Republican state governors, or the Trump White House. Again, that we'll probably find in retrospect that we did make some bad decisions, but you can't say that in any way that was malevolent or anyone was attempting to do them in a way because they didn't care about people's lives. So this was Nancy Pelosi, again, doubling down on the election. I think one of the saddest things that we have seen since the beginning of this virus has been a concerted Democratic attempt to suggest that the White House is responsible for anything that happened as a result of it. Unfortunately, the White House has played into that at times with the president saying, you know, we fixed this, we've handled it, it's done, it's going to be great, when you really just couldn't say that. And it set up some expectations that now Democrats are really using an attempt to undermine the administration as they move into an election period.
Hang tight, we'll be right back. You are listening to Potomac Watch from the Wall Street Journal.
U.S. businesses thrive on Alibaba's online marketplace, where sales by American companies to Chinese consumers added $53 billion to the U.S. economy in 2022. Discover more at AlibabaPowersBusinesses.com.
From the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal, this is Potomac Watch.
Welcome back. Another thing that strikes me about the briefing on Tuesday is just that it gives Trump the opportunity to talk about some of the good news, too, which there is some of. I mean, a couple of things that he mentioned is two vaccine candidates that are entering final stage clinical trials. He says that they're all, you know, the top candidates of these vaccines, since there are several others in earlier stages of trials, that the top candidates are being mass produced. Trump said that logistically we have the military ready to go, suggesting that the armed forces would help distribute this in record time, he said. But it's interesting. I mean, we also have this treatment that has come out, remdesivir, which has studies have shown can help COVID patients recover sooner. And it's interesting. There are six Democrats, including Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren, who sent a letter to the Trump administration saying that this drug has created, quote, windfall revenues for its maker, Gilead Sciences, and suggesting that the government assert legal provisions that, quote, allow it to assert control over the production and distribution of remdesivir, unquote, essentially suggesting, Bill, that the government, as I understand it, stomp on the patent of the drug. What do you make of that argument? I mean, is that going anywhere? Is that the sort of argument that's inevitable from people like Bernie Sanders in a situation like this?
Absolutely. The way they proceed is assume the creation of a life-saving vaccine that from our private sector. Then the government's going to step in and decide what price it can be sold at, to whom it can be sold at, how much you can produce, and so forth. I think it's crazy. One reason that it's more likely that the United States comes up with the vaccine is that we have a much more competitive system. And this would just give the worst incentives. We have a good editorial explaining the pricing behind this and what the assumption is. But again, so many just assume that you have the product that you want, and then think the government knows exactly where it should go and at what price it could be sold. And I think that's insane.
Yeah, a couple of details from that editorial, which says that the government essentially negotiated a deal to get 100% of the production of remdesivir for July and 90% of the production from August. And hospitals, the letter says, from these senators, will pay about $3,200 for a course of the drug, which the argument is, Kim, that if somebody ends up spending 3 or 5 days less in the hospital, you'll essentially make up that difference. And the similar argument seems to be bubbling up on the vaccine side. I mean, there's a headline that I found pretty remarkable in the New York Times yesterday. I saw it's, quote, some vaccine makers say they plan to profit from coronavirus vaccine, unquote. And I mean, I thought that's what allowed them to get capital, allowed them to ramp up research and production, allowed them to develop the vaccine or the next life-saving drug or vaccine.
Yeah, it's the only reason we have any of this stuff. And the bigger joke of this is, if you look at the complaints that is being made by the Elizabeth Warrens and Bernie Sanders of the world, they are angry that if you look at what Gilead, the maker of this drug, is charging private insurers for the treatment versus what they are charging the government, private insurers are being charged more. And so the Democrats are saying, see, that just shows, you know, how greedy they are, because now if you're in a hospital and you're getting private insurance, you're going to have to pay more. What this doesn't note is that the only reason the government is paying less for this is because we actually have regulations that require drug makers to give government programs a big discount off of their wholesale price. And so somehow Democrats are sort of trying to turn this around. Rather than saying, oh, we're getting a better deal for the government, they're complaining about the wholesale price of this overall. And how do they expect companies like this to ever get the money back to do yet more research, to pay off the enormous investment that went into the drugs they've already produced? I mean, let's just first steps here, by the way, first principles. This is a private company. We should be celebrating its innovation, not threatening to take away its patents and strip it of everything that it worked so hard to get. That's a government taking. And just because it's drugs and just because it's the word here is life-saving treatment, it doesn't necessarily change principles of private property and innovation.
And Bill, to me, I mean, this would be a great argument that President Trump could take up for 5 minutes in one of these briefings. Talk about, the history behind this drug, how it was developed a long time ago. Talk about the costs of getting a drug through FDA review. I don't know. I mean, I guess I don't quite envision the White House doing that, but I don't see why they shouldn't.
Yeah, I agree with you. I can envision the White House doing it because, you know, in these debates, so often the opposition just says, well, the government can step in, fix the problem, make things cheaper and so forth. And then Republicans are in this sort of awkward position of saying, no, it has to be more expensive. The president should. He has the bully pulpit, and part of his job and part of making his life easier would be to explain how things work and why. He would oppose this. So I think it would be a very good lesson if he would use the pulpit for that and to explain what's behind, you know, what goes into the making of a drug and the marketing of a drug and the kind of expansion of the drug's use. Look, the government didn't get involved in iPhones, but anyone, you know, around the world can get an iPhone now, and the price keeps dropping. For them, because that's the way the market works. The market creates something that's initially expensive, but because whoever creates it has an interest in getting more customers, and then other people come up with rival products, there's a downward pressure on price. And I think would be an excellent use of presidential time to make that case on TV at one of these briefings.
Meanwhile, the negotiations in Congress are ongoing on the next phase of coronavirus relief legislation. I think we're in the third day of negotiations now. Kim, where do things stand? Is there any movement that you can see?
Not really. And that is entirely because Republicans seem unable to come to an agreement themselves. So you did have Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell give a briefing yesterday in which he teased, as it were, the main aspects of things that he said that Republicans could generally agree on. And they fell under kids, jobs, and health is how he described it. But if you break those things out, even within there, there's still a lot of wrangling within the GOP about how this should go. So, for instance, they're talking about $105 billion for schools to help schools get back on their feet. But there is divide within the caucus about whether or not that money should be tethered to whether or not schools are actually physically reopening or not. There's discussion about another round of money for the PPP program for small business loans, but some people are pushing back against that, noting that the program still had money in it that hasn't been drawn out yet. So it still has a reserve. And then you get into the even bigger issues. The White House is demanding a payroll tax cut. There's general opposition among Republicans to that, and also the question of whether or not a program like that, you would waive the payroll tax or would you just defer it? It would have to be repaid down the road. There are huge arguments over what to do about the enhanced unemployment program, with some Republicans saying we need to maintain it in some form and scale it back, but other Republicans saying, look, this is doing so much damage. It's discouraging people from going back to work. We need to kill it outright. Fights over whether or not households should get another round of direct checks. And so there was a meeting yesterday between Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin and White House Chief of Staff Mark Meadows and the Republicans at their weekly lunch. There seemed to have been a little bit of a progress made there, in particular about spending some more money for states to do testing and tracing. But the big issues still remain unresolved.
And to dig just into a couple of those things that you mentioned, the payroll tax cut is kind of a divide, it seems, between the White House and Congress. Trump has pushed for it over the weekend. Talking to Chris Wallace, he said that he would consider not signing whatever bill comes out of this if it doesn't have a payroll tax. tax cut. Bill, what's the argument for or against that? I mean, do you think that is a good approach here?
I'm kind of at war with myself over this. On the one hand, I'm not generally a fan of payroll tax cuts because they tend to be temporary. So I don't think they really have the long-term impact on an economy that a regular tax cut would. So I'm very skeptical of it. Now, some people believe that if they got a tax cut, a payroll tax cut through on this, it might become permanent, but that's not clear to me. On the other hand, the advantage of a payroll tax cut is at least people are keeping their own money and not spending other people's money, right? It's one of the few sort of growth aspects of what's being considered in Congress. I tend to think, the lines that I'd be drawing, I tend to think that getting rid of the federal $600 a month unemployment bonus would be a big thing in getting the economy kicked up again, because it keeps a lot of people from working because they make more money not working than they do working. And I think Senator McConnell's right to look for liability protection so that, as he says, the COVID-19 epidemic isn't replaced by a lawsuit epidemic. So I'm kind of thinking we're fighting a war on not necessarily the strongest front here.
That $600 a week federal unemployment supplement is the next thing that I was going to ask about. Mitch McConnell, I think, had said that that was not going to be a part of the next bill. There's some talk now, some proposals, maybe it should be $400 a week, and then fewer people would make more on unemployment than they do at work. But one sort of wrinkle here is that federal supplement officially ends July 31st, I believe next Friday, but there are some reports now saying that because state benefits are paid on a week ending generally a Saturday or Sunday, that they can't pay next week practically. So that practically this benefit is going to end at the end of this week. So Kim, I mean, that puts a deadline of a few days on this. And what are the chances that an agreement would be reached before that?
Indeed. And that is why it probably would have been better for Republicans to have generally had their ducks in an order before they came back from this last break, if only to not put themselves in a situation where they're going to get jammed against a deadline like that, or open themselves up to attacks by Democrats that they are leaving people hanging out there. And again, it's the real problem of why they weren't sounding from the same notebook here as well, too. I think some of the blame for this, especially on issues that should have been straightforward. Look, we should not be renewing these unemployment benefits. There are other ways you could go about getting help to people other than this, which is a direct disincentive to work. And that was generally the view among Republicans. They were pretty firm on that until suddenly Steve Mnuchin came out and said, oh, well, you know, we're open to this. We'd have to scale it back. But it sort of put them on the back foot. So yes, there is a deadline. What does seem clear is Republicans, at least from a starting point, are agreed that you shouldn't be providing people benefits that exceed what they earned in their prior income. But how do you do that on an individual basis, especially when you're talking about the federal government here, or landing it on states to have to figure out that information and deal with it in that way is very complicated and technical for starters. It would seem to me much wiser to say, look, we're not going to redo this, but, you know, here's how we're going to support people that are continuing to be out of work in other ways.
Well, and speaking of not being on the same page, there are at least a few senators who seem to be wondering why we're doing this bill at all. So Rand Paul, the libertarianish Republican, left one of those meetings with Republicans. And here's what he said. He said, quote, I just walked out of a meeting that could be sort of a Bernie Bros progressive caucus. I'm alarmed that we're talking about spending another $1 trillion we don't have, unquote. What do you make of that perspective, Bill?
I think it's healthy to have that perspective. I mean, we're spending trillions of dollars, and it's good for some people to ask, what are we getting for our dollars here? And I think there's not enough of this. I'm not sure exactly where I draw the line. that I draw where these senators do. But I think we need more of this instead of just throwing money at it. Because, again, there seems to be an impression that the way we get out of this is with having the government substitute tax dollars for private dollars. But the way we get out of it is really getting this economy back to work. There was nothing wrong with the economy. It's been closed because of a medical emergency. And I think in many ways, the best thing the government can do is get out of the way and let the ordinary talents of American citizens in a free market rise again.
All right, we'll leave it there. Thank you, Kim and Bill. Thank you all for listening. We'll be back later this week with another edition of Potomac Watch.
U.S. businesses thrive on Alibaba's online marketplace, where sales by American companies to Chinese consumers added $53 billion to the U.S. economy in 2022. Discover more at alibabapowersbusinesses.com.